a catch as I took standing well behind the wicket. I had slipped away from the festivities in B.C. Gandhi's room, my fingers sore despite the keeper's glove, and my knees aching. I planned an early night. "Come in," I said. He scanned the dark room, getting his bearings. If he saw the shadow of my bed, he didn't see me because he looked away, to the light leaking from under the bathroom door. Then to the curtained window. When he looked back, I was sitting up. It gave him a start. He shut the door and stood there, a man who had walked into his past. I waited. I hadn't invited him here. The seconds ticked away, and he showed no inclination to speak. I had to give him this. He tracked me down. He figured it out. Perhaps he did register my presence in the operating room the day he peeked over my shoulder. Perhaps in the auditorium when I answered his question, he saw in my face features of my mother or of himself. How strange to spot a son you've never seen or thought of till the day he appears at Morbidity and Mortality Conference and gives new meaning to that activity. "You might as well sit," I said. I didn't offer to turn on the light. There was a chair beyond my bed. He walked forward quickly, like a blind man who'd risk bumping into something rather than seem hesitant or ask for help. He sat down hard. I didn't think he could see my face. I studied his. As his eyes adjusted, he looked at my possessions. I had more things than he did, if you didn't count books. I saw him linger on the framed print of the Ecstasy of St. Teresa. He must have recognized at once where that came from. Oh, yes, and the finger in the jar. He knew he was in the right room. The minutes passed. It was 10 at night. "Mind if I smoke?" he said at last. "You don't smoke." I hadn't picked up the smell of cigarettes in his condo. Just his scent, which my nostrils registered again. "I do now. When did you start?" His nose was pretty good. I took my time answering. "Since coming here. It's a prerequisite for surgical training. Go ahead." He fumbled in his shirt pocket and brought out two cigarettes. I thought of Ali and his little souk, the only place I knew where you could buy loose smokes. In America, you bought them in cartons or by the truckload. He held a cigarette out to me. I stared at it. He was about to withdraw his hand when I took it. He flicked his lighter and stood to meet me as I swung my feet over the side of the bed. His fingers shielded the fire, a nine-fingered sepulchre. I bowed to the flame and drew till my tip glowed. "Thank you, Father." I sat back on the bed. He found an old styrofoam cup in arm's reach. I took a thoughtful draw, passing judgment on his cigarette. It was a Rothmans, a throwback to his Ethiopian days, or, lest I forget, his British days. Rothmans was also what we puffed at Our Lady, courtesy of B.C. Gandhi, who got cartons at deep discount from Canal Street. The smoke made sinuous shapes in the shaft of light leaking past the bathroom door. I remembered our kitchen at Missing and how the dust motes dancing in the morning rays formed their own galaxy. When I was a child, that sight had hinted at the wonderful and frightening complexity of the universe, of how the closer one looked, the more one saw revealed, and one's imagination was the only limit. "I don't expect you to understand," he said, and for a moment I thought he was talking about the dust motes. The sound of his voice irritated me. Who gave him permission to speak? In my room. "Then let's not talk about it." More silence. He cracked first. "How do you like surgery?" Did I really want to answer him? By answering, was I conceding something? I had to think about this for a few minutes. Let him sweat. "How do I like surgery? I am lucky to have Deepak. He takes great pains with me. The basics, good habits. I think it is so important. I climbed up then. I felt I had said too much. I detected in my tone a need for his approval, his affirmation. That was the last thing I wanted. I thought of Ghosh, who became an accidental surgeon because of Stone's departure. He had no one to teach him. Ah, Ghosh. Ghosh's dying wish was that.
I know some of the people Deepak trained with, Stone said, interrupting my train of thought.
Ghosh's message to him could wait. This wasn't the time. I wasn't in the mood.
Oh, really? I made inquiries about him. You are lucky.
But Deepak isn't lucky.
He is going to get screwed all over again. In fact, we all are.
Maybe not, he said. I didn't pursue this. No favors, please. I wanted nothing from him. He squirmed in his chair, but not from discomfort. It was what he was holding back, waiting for me to ask. I would not give him the pleasure.
I had a Deepak in my life, he said. All it takes is one. Mine was a Dr. Braithwaite, a stickler for the right way. I appreciate him more now than I did then. Despite him, after all these years, I find it extraordinarily difficult to...
The words had dried up on his tongue. This was such an effort, a physical trial for him to converse. He wasn't a man who ever spoke like this, I didn't think. Sharing his inner thoughts wasn't something he had practiced. Not even with himself. I gave him lots of time.
What? You find it extraordinarily difficult to...
What?
I should have just told him to leave. Here I was conversing, helping him along. I find it difficult to operate. Particularly elective surgery. I have anxieties.
He spoke slowly, drawing out his words.
No one knows. Even if I'm doing a hernia or a hydrocele, in fact, the simpler the operation, the more likely this is to happen. I have to look up the surgical anatomy, go over all the steps in an operative book, even though after all these years I don't need to. I'm terrified I will forget, or that my mind will go blank. Sometimes I throw up in the lounge. I feel sick, dizzy. It has never stopped. It made me consider giving up surgery. It's worse if it's someone I know. The hospital employee brings his mother.
I thought of the surgical anatomy atlas I had seen in his condominium, a big folio book, and next to it an operative anatomy atlas, both open on his desk as if they were the last things he looked at before he left his apartment.
What about the day I... The day of your morbidity and mortality conference? Exactly. Early that morning I had to do a simple breast lump excision, and if the biopsy was positive, then a mastectomy and auxiliary node dissection. I've done hundreds of them, maybe more. But this was one of our nurses. Someone putting faith in me.
So what happened?
I walked into the theater, feeling as if I were about to faint. No one knows, of course. The mask helps. But as soon as I make the incision, it all vanishes. Then it feels silly to have been so anxious. Ridiculous. It'll never happen again, I tell myself. But it does.
Did it ever happen in Ethiopia? He shook his head.
I think it was because I knew I was the only choice the patient had. There were no other options. Two other surgeons in the whole city. Here there are so many surgeons.
Or maybe those lives weren't as valuable. Natives, right? Who cares?
The alternative was death anyway, so why worry? Just like you come and take organs from our patients at Our Lady.
He flinched. I sensed that no one ever talked to him in this manner. We hadn't agreed to any rules. If he didn't like it, he could just leave. He had come to Our Lady. This wasn't Mecca. He clamped his lips together.
I don't expect you to understand, he said.
I knew he wasn't talking about his surgical anxieties. He patted his pockets. He didn't find what he was looking for. So he just sat there and blinked, waiting for more punishment. He slumped down in the chair. He had crossed his legs and hooked his free foot under the calf of the other like a twisted vine.
You see, Marian...
He wasn't used to saying my name.
It is not as if everything can be explained by logic.
Now he uncrossed his legs and leaned forward.
I can't give you a neat explanation about why I did what I did, because I don't understand it myself, even after all these years.
Which it was he talking about? I had my daggers lined up and my lances and mace ready just behind them. I thought of all kinds of clever things to say. Save your breath. Or, I understand, all right. You took the path less traveled. You bailed out. What else is there to understand? But perhaps he meant the it of impregnating my mother.
Ghosh said you didn't know how it happened, that it was a mystery to you. Yes, he said, relieved. But then I sensed he was blushing. He said that? Yes, it was.
Like Joseph? Clueless about Mary and the baby? Babies, in your case?
Yes.
He crossed his legs. Maybe you don't think you are my father.
No, it's not that. I am your father.
No, you're not. Ghosh was my father. He raised me. He taught me everything from riding a bike to hitting a square drive off the back foot. He gave me my love for medicine. He raised me and Shiva. I am here because of Ghosh. A greater man never lived. I had baited the trap, lured him in. But I was the one who snapped.
Lived,
he said, leaning forward, the foot no longer wagging. Ghosh is dead. His features turned leaden, then pale. I let him ruminate on that. I'm sure he wanted to know how, why, but he couldn't ask. The news had stopped him cold, saddened him, I could see. Good. I was touched. But I wasn't done kicking him. I was impressed that he took it, waited for more. So you are off the hook, I said. I had a father.
He sighed. I don't expect you to understand, he said again.
Tell me anyway.
Where shall I start?
Begin at the beginning and go on until you come to the end, the king said very gravely. Then stop. Do you know who said that? I was enjoying myself. The famous Thomas Stone being grilled, getting screwed, getting a dose of his own medicine. Sure, he could rattle off the branches of the external carotid artery or the boundaries of the foramen of Winslow, but did he know his Lewis Carroll? Did he know his Alice in Wonderland? He surprised me with his answer. It was wrong, but it was right.
Ghosh, he said, and the air went out of his lungs.
Chapter 45. A Matter of Time. When Thomas Stone was a child, he asked the Mali, the gardener, where little boys came from. The Mali, a dark man with muddy eyes and acid breath from the previous night's arak, said,
You came with the evening tide, of course. I found you.
You were succulent and pink with one long fin and no scales. Such fish, they say, only exist in Ceylon, but there you were. I almost ate you, but I wasn't hungry. I cut off the fin with this very sickle and brought you to your mother.
I don't believe you. My mother and I must have washed in from the sea together. We were one large fish. I was in a belly and came out,
the little boy said, walking away. The Mali could coax roses out of the earth where their neighbors failed. But Hilda Stone would have fired him for telling such tales to her only child. The little boy's home was just outside the rock walls of Fort St. George in Madras, India. The spire of St. Mary's poked up from behind the incomplete battlements. Its quaint, well-tended cemetery was his playground, a place where more than 5 generations of English men, women, and babies were buried, taken by typhoid, malaria, Kala Azar, and rarely old age. Fort St. George was the first home of the East India Company. St. Mary's, built in 1680, was the first Anglican church in India, but by no means the first church, that being the one built in A.D. 54 by St. Thomas the Apostle who landed on the Kerala coast. A plaque inside St. Mary's commemorated the marriage of Lord Clive and another that of Governor Elihu Yale, who later founded a university in America. But the little boy saw no plaque to commemorate the marriage of Hilda Masters of Fife, tutor and governess, to Justice Stone, civil servant in the British Raj and almost 2 decades her senior. Thomas thought every child grew up as he did, in sight of the Indian Ocean, hearing the fearsome-sounding waves crashing around Fort St. George. And he assumed that all fathers were like his, crashing into furniture and making alarming sounds at night. Justice K. Stone's voice rumbled down from a height, and his bottle-brush mustache kept little boys at bay. District collectors in the Indian Civil Service were demigods, with secretaries and peons hovering around them like flies around overripe mangoes. Collectors went on tours for weeks at a time, holding court in each city. When Justice Stone was home, despite his noisy presence, he was somehow not there. Thomas understood, in the way that children do, even though they lack words to express themselves, that Justice was a self-centered man and neglectful of his wife. Perhaps this was why Hilda turned to religion. To imagine Christ's suffering allowed her to live with hers. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed the young governess who marries a DC hoping to clear his yellow tin skin of quinine and cure his taste for gin and native women, for hers is the kingdom of heaven. Hilda's blessing came in the form of her blue-eyed, tow-headed boy, whose feet she hardly let touch the ground, even when he was old enough to walk. The little boy's ayah, Sebesti, had nothing to do other than join in the play, since it was Hilda who let him ride on her back, pretending he was Jim Corbett, the big game hunter, and she the elephant carrying him to the tiger blind. Hilda drew red chalk wickets on the whitewashed walls and bowled to him with a tennis ball. She sang hymns to him and fanned him when it was too humid to fall asleep. The bell-like clarity of her voice caused somnolent lizards on the wall to snap to attention. Her brown hair, parted in the center, fell from a steepled head. Regardless of how she restrained it, a frizzy halo framed her face. In the middle of the night, he reached for her, and she was there. But on the nights Justice Stone was home, the little boy slept poorly, fearful for his mother because those were the only times she left his bed. He kept vigil with his cricket bat outside the closed bedroom door, prepared to break in if the noises did not subside. They always did, and only then would he retreat to his room. In the morning, when he opened his eyes, she would be back in his bed, awake and peering out through her fringe of hair. Every child should have a mother of such even temperament, her rare displeasure evidenced so gently that the effect was lasting. Thomas lived to please his mother and he was earnest in his pleasing. It was as if they both knew, though they could not have known, that life was short, the moment fleeting.
He was 8 when Hilda had to excuse herself from the St. Mary's choir. A cough that at first was like distant artillery soon sounded like nails rattling in a paper bag.
Dr. Winthrop, an overdressed man who did not converse as much as make pronouncements, said mother and son were to sleep apart.
For the child's betterment.
The little boy heard her nightly paroxysms from the other room and covered his ears with the pillows.
Undoubtedly consumption, Dr. Winthrop said to Thomas
one day, using a delicate word for tuberculosis as he put away his stethoscope and thermometer.
It has turned dry, the sicker form of phthisis, you know.
He talked to the little boy as if to a colleague and shook his hand with gravity. When would she get better?
Rest and diet and hydrotherapy, said the doctor. Some of the time, let's say much of the time, it becomes quiescent. After all, it's not up to us, is it, Master Stone?
When Thomas asked, please, sir, who might it be up to? Winthrop raised his eyes to the ceiling. It was only later that the little boy understood the doctor did not mean Justice, whose heavy tread shook the chandelier. He meant God. One morning, Thomas awoke, dreaming of horse-drawn carriages and with the thunder of hooves echoing in his ear. He discovered that in the night his mother had coughed up blood, lots of it, and Winthrop had been summoned. They bundled her off, not letting her kiss her son's brow. She travelled to Coimbatore, and from there the narrow-gauge toy train took her up the mountain to a hill station sitting just below Uti. Dr. Ross had built a sanatorium in the Nilgiri Hills, fashioned after Trudeau's famed Saranac Lake in New York. The white cottages around the hospital were replicas of those at Saranac, with the same airy porches and trundle beds. Thomas wept himself to sleep on Sebesti's bony chest. He was angry with Hilda for getting sick, for having fostered such a closeness with him so as to make this separation unbearable. He was not like his schoolmates who loved their ayahs more than their parents and cared nothing about long separations. Overnight, Sebesti blossomed into a surrogate mother. But Thomas was wary of giving her his love, for then she, too, might disappear. Before school, Thomas visited St. Mary's and recited 50 Our Father Hail Marys and did the same on his way back. He was on his knees so often that boggy sacks formed under his kneecaps. Around his neck, he fastened with twine the heavy crucifix that had been on her wall, hiding it under his school uniform where it gouged the skin over his breastbone and the twine cut into his neck. Not having a firstborn or a ram or a ewe, he sacrificed his Don Bradman signature cricket bat, smashed it on the washing stone. He fasted till he was dizzy. He cut his forearm with the razor, spilling blood onto the shrine for the Virgin Mary that he built in his room. Sebesti took him to the Mumbalam temple and even to the tiny pavement temple behind their house. If it was up to God, he did not seem to listen. Meanwhile, his father never missed a stop on his circuit. Vellore, Madurai, Tuticorin, and parts in between. When Justice Stone was home, he barely had time to remove his pith helmet or unpack his bags before he was off again. Justice called his son the Archbishop of Canterbury, and if these were words of reassurance, they did nothing for Thomas. He spoke to his son as if he were addressing multitudes. At night, Thomas could hear his uneven footsteps like those of a giant in a bedroom of Lilliputian dimensions who could not help knocking over furniture. It was a relief when Justice went out on tour again. A year passed with Thomas living all but parentless in the big house, along with Sebesti, Durai, the cook, Damali, Satuma, who washed clothes and swabbed the tile floors, and an untouchable who came once a week to clean the toilets. That was his family. On Christmas Day,
son and backslapping father came together for dinner. His father's clerk, Andrew Fothergill, was their sole guest.
Well, what a feast!
Good to have you all. Fine repast, just fine. Eat, do eat!
This, when it was just the three of them at the table, with Durai waiting behind the kitchen door.
We can't let them get away with it all. There is money to be made in Koria. Rope, you know, or matting. We earned it, I'll say, and by golly, we are going to have it.
And on he went, barely stopping to swallow, the crumbs spraying from his lips. Fothergill tried valiantly to connect Justifus's thoughts, to give his superior's scattered remarks a spine, a thread of meaning. Justifus began to rub one thigh, then the other, fidgeting, glancing down with irritation as if the dog were underfoot. But of course she never came into the house when Justifus was around. By the time pudding was served, the leg rubbing was so furious that Thomas had to ask, "Please, sir, what is wrong?"
"I have fur on my legs, son. Keeps me from feeling, it does. Ruddy nuisance!"
His father struggled to rise, almost upsetting the table in the process. He stumbled out, grabbed sideboard and wall, his feet sticking like magnets to the floor. Thomas remembered Fothergill's look of consolation as the boy saw the guest to the door.
"January 20. My darling son. My temperatures were 36.7, 37.2, 37.8, 37.3. I threw out the 38.6 because I didn't believe it. They roll our beds out to the porch and back in at night. In and out. I'm not even allowed to go to the lavatory. Total bed rest, though the huge effort this requires seems to be against the idea of rest. I find it difficult to believe that on this porch, with the mist outside and the air so cold, that a body can generate a temperature over 36 degrees. No wonder we are called warm-blooded animals."
She had circled a splotch on the page and captioned it with, "My tears as I cry for you, my darling boy." In each letter, Hilda told him that he must be brave and be patient. Time for Thomas was no longer divided by days and nights or seasons. Time was a seamless yearning for his mother.
"They say I have not made any great improvement, but that I should be glad I am no worse."
He went through the motions at school. She exhorted him to pray, told him that she prayed every hour and that God listened and prayer never failed. He prayed constantly, convinced that at the very least the prayers kept her alive.
"I know God did not mean to keep us apart, and soon he will bring us back together."
One day, Thomas woke to find his pillow moist. When Sebesti lit the lamp, there was the mark of the beast. A fine red spray on his pillow. A strangely beautiful pattern. Sebesti wept, but he was overjoyed. He knew this meant he would see his mother again. Why didn't he think of this sooner? Two barefoot stretcher-bearers in crisp white drill met his train in Uti. They took him directly to Hilda's cottage. He climbed into her narrow cot, into her arms. He was 11 years old.
"Your coming is the best and worst present I could ever have," she said.
Grey and shrunk to her bones, she was a shadow of the mother he once knew. Her playfulness was gone, but then so was the reciprocity it might have found in this gangly son of hers whose eyes were haunted and ringed by worry lines. They sat side by side on the porch of their cottage, their fingers intertwined like dried roots. In the early morning, they watched the tea-pickers float by on the footpath, their feet hidden in the mist, their lunch-pails creaking with every step. During the day, only the nurses interrupted their solitude to take their temperatures and to bring tiffin and medications. By dusk, when they saw the tea-pickers head home, it was time for sleep. Since Hilda had no wind, he read to her. She wept with pride at his precocious fluency.
The cane-bottomed lounge chairs had large armrests and a writing pallet made from the same teak. Here they penned letters to each other, put them into envelopes, and sealed them. After lunch, they exchanged envelopes, tore them open, and read their letters. They prayed at least 3 times a day. In the most bitter cold, they remained outside, bundled up. At first, Thomas was light-headed from the altitude. He grew stronger. His cough lessened. But nothing, not fresh air, or milk, meat, or eggs, or the tonics that were forced on her, helped Hilda. Her cough was different. It was a honking, bleating sound. He noticed that she had an exquisitely painful swelling at her breastbone, pushing up under her blouse. He was embarrassed to ask about it, and careful not to let his head rest there. Once, when she was undressing, he caught a glimpse. It was as big as a robin's egg, but a darker color. He assumed it was the consumption, the phthisis, the tubercle bacillus, the Cox agent, TB, the mycobacterium. Whatever name it had, it was a treacherous enemy ripening within her. One evening, as they lay next to each other, their beds pulled together, and as he read to her from the daily worship book, she exclaimed in surprise. He looked back at the sentence to see if he had missed a word. He looked up to see blood staining her white nightgown and spreading out as if she had been shot. As long as he lived, he would remember that in the awful moment when she realized she was dying, and when her eyes sought his, her first thought, her only thought, was about abandoning her son. For a second, Thomas was paralyzed. Then he jumped up and pulled aside the soggy blouse. A red geyser shot up from her chest and arced to the ceiling, then fell to earth. In the next instant, it did it again. And again. A pulsing, obscene blood fountain, timed to every beat of her heart, kept striking the ceiling, showering him, the bed, and her face with blood, soaking the pages of the open book. He recoiled from the monstrous sight, this eruption from his mother's chest which painted everything around it red. When it occurred to him to try to staunch it with the bedsheet, the jet was already dropping in height, as if the tank were empty. Hilda lay soaked in her blood, her face white as porcelain and flecked with scarlet. She was gone. Thomas cradled her soggy head, his tears falling on her face. When Dr. Ross arrived, a white coat thrown over his pajamas, he said to Thomas, "It was inevitable. That aneurysm has been ticking in her chest for over a year. It was just a matter of time." He reassured Thomas that the blood was not infective. The thought had not crossed the boy's mind.
Alone, truly alone, Thomas developed fever and a cough. He refused to be moved from the cottage to the infirmary. The cottage was the last thing on earth to connect him to his mother. He let them take him for an X-ray. Later, he watched Muthukrishnan, the compounder, arrive with a pushcart carrying the bulky pneumothorax apparatus in its polished wooden case. Muthu squatted on the balcony and, after wiping his face with a towel, he opened the wings of the fancy box and began unpacking the large bottles, manometers, and tubing. Dr. Ross, himself once a consumptive, soon cycled up. "The X-ray was no good, lad. No good at all," Ross said. It was just a matter of time, Thomas thought. He looked forward to joining his mother. He didn't flinch as the needle went between his ribs posteriorly and into the pleural space that lined the lung, a space that was normally a vacuum, Ross explained. "Now we measure pressures." He maneuvered the needle while Muthu fiddled with the two bottles, raising and lowering them on Ross's command. "This is artificial pneumothorax. Fancy way of saying that we put air in that vacuum that lines your chest to collapse the infected part of the lung, lad. Those cock bacteria need their oxygen to thrive, and we won't give it to them, will we?" Face down, from the depths of his illness,
Thomas thought this reasoning was illogical. What about my oxygen, Dr. Ross? But he said nothing. For 24 hours, Thomas had to lie prone, propped in position by sandbags. Muthu came by many times a day to check on him. Muthu noted the sudden fever and the chills. The artificial pneumothorax had introduced other bacteria into the pleural space around the lung. He heard Ross's voice from afar.
Empyema, my boy. That's what we call pus collecting around the lung. Doesn't happen that often in my hands, but it does happen. I'm so sorry. Alas, the pus is too thick to come out with a needle, Ross said.
For the operation, they took him to a tiled room with high windows. It seemed bare but for a narrow raised table in the middle, over which was suspended a giant dish light resembling the compound eye of an insect. The place left a strong impression on the boy. It was otherworldly, hallowed ground but still secular. The name theatre was fitting. Ross cut into the skin, under local anesthesia, just to the outside of the left nipple, then exposed 3 adjacent ribs and cut out short segments from them, thereby unroofing or saucerizing the empyema cavity. The pus had no place to collect. Despite the anesthesia, Thomas had moments of excruciating pain. When he could speak, Thomas asked,
"Won't an opening like that destroy the vacuum in the pleural space? Won't it cause air to rush in and the whole lung to collapse?"
"Brilliant question, lad," Ross said, delighted. "It would collapse in anybody else, but the infection, the empyema, has stiffened the lining of your lung, made it thick and inflexible, like a scab. So in your case, the lung won't collapse back."
For a week, pus oozed out onto gauze padding strapped over the hole. When it slowed to a trickle, Ross stuffed the wound with gauze tape to cause it to heal by secondary intention. During dressing changes, Thomas studied his crater with a mirror, taking perverse pride in what it produced and the day-to-day changes as his body made repairs. Ross was a short, cheerful man with the roundest and most forgettable of faces and the bow legs of a jockey. He always warmed the chest piece of his stethoscope in his chubby hands before letting the metal touch Thomas's skin. He percussed Thomas's chest, sounding it out skillfully. Ross pulled out the gauze and they peered into the crater.
"You see the red, pebbly-looking base, Thomas? We call that the granulation tissue. It will slowly fill up the wound and allow skin to form over it."
And that was exactly what happened. At one point, the granulation tissue grew excessively, pouching out like a strawberry.
"Proud flesh," Ross called it.
Holding a crystal of copper sulfate in his forceps, he rubbed it over the proud flesh, burning it back. One day, Ross brought him Metchnikoff's Immunity in Infectious Diseases, along with Osler's Principles and Practice of Medicine. Metchnikoff was hard-going, but Thomas liked the drawings of white cells eating bacteria. Osler was surprisingly readable. In a life that was merely a prelude to death, Thomas found he looked forward to Ross's visit, to the short man's daily rituals. And yet he held back his affection for the doctor, because that was a recipe for loss.
"I'm not going away, lad," Ross said one day. "And since you are staying, why don't you join us on rounds?"
Ross turned and left, not waiting for an answer. When Ross pronounced him healed, Thomas had been at the sanatorium for 1.5 years. During that time, he never saw his father. Fothergill came twice, saying Justophus Stone was too ill to travel. Thomas asked Ross about the illness from which his father suffered. Ross said, "It's not tuberculosis, but something else."
"To do with his legs?"
Ross tousled Thomas's hair.
"Something punky, lad. Unfortunate it is. He is bedridden. You'll learn in medical school," he said.
It was the first time Ross had ever uttered the words "medical school" to Thomas. Thomas couldn't control the fluttering in his heart, as if a door had cracked open in his coal cellar, bringing in light, promising a future when he had visualized none.
Ross, now officially Thomas's guardian, decided Thomas should go to boarding school in England. Thomas didn't even consider going to see his father in the infirmary in Madras before he sailed. 2 terms had gone by when Ross wrote to say that Justifus had died. A modest inheritance under Ross's guardianship would allow him to finish schooling and go to university. Ross had led Thomas in the direction of medical school as if it were inevitable. Thomas had no reason to resist. Life thus far had convinced him of his aptitude for 2 things, sickness and suffering. In medical school in Edinburgh, he lost himself in his studies, finding a stability and a sanctity missing before. He had no need to lift his head from his books, no desire to go anywhere but for classes or demonstrations. When his eyes tired, he went diffidently to the infirmary, hoping no one would throw him out. He got to know a house officer here, a senior student there, and before long, and well before his class had reached the clinical years, he was being pointed to interesting patients. The hospital porter named him the Lurker, and Thomas didn't mind. In the organized chaos of the hospital, in the labyrinth of corridors, in the stink and confinement of its walls, he found both order and refuge. He found home. Misery and suffering were his closest kin. A drunk named Jones looked eerily like his father. Thomas realized it was the waxy complexion, the swollen parotids, the loss of the outer third of the eyebrows, and the puffy eyelids of alcoholism that gave both men a leonine appearance. Now that he was trained to see, he put together the other clues he recalled. Red palms, the starburst of capillaries on cheek and neck, the womanly breasts, and the absence of armpit hair. His father had cirrhosis. Perhaps that was the punky thing that Ross had been too polite to mention. It was sleeting on a bitter cold evening in the Founder's Library when the final piece came together, and when it did, Thomas slammed his book shut, alarming Mrs. Pincus, the librarian. The young man, who practically lived in the study carrel farthest from the fireplace, suddenly ran out into the spitting snow, hatless and distraught. Thomas negotiated the long corridor leading to his room in the pitch dark. Walking in the dark was something his father could not have done. The signals coming up from Thomas's toe and ankle and knee told him where he was in space, but in Justifus Stone those messages had been blocked in his spinal cord. His father's stamping, crashing gait, always worse at night when he no longer could see where his feet were planted. That was from syphilis of the spinal cord, or tabes dorsalis. No child should possess such knowledge of a parent. The meandering conversation, the boastful tales at the dinner table, the delusions of grandeur, that was syphilis of the brain, not just the spinal cord. Once in his room, Thomas tripped before the wardrobe mirror. With a second handheld mirror, he examined every inch of his skin. No syphilids. No gumma on his skin. He listened to his heart, but heard nothing unusual. He'd been spared congenital syphilis. But then he realized that his fear was absurd, because congenital syphilis had to come through the placenta to him. It had to come from his mother. Absurd for him to worry. What his mother had was tuberculosis, pure as the virgin. His mother could never have had. He cried out suddenly, the anguish of a child whose final illusion is stripped away. He understood at last. It had been under his nose all this time. Tuberculosis didn't cause aneurysms like the one that killed her, but syphilis did. Mother! Poor mother! He cried, grieving for her all over again. His father had murdered Hilda with his unbridled lust. She might have recovered from her TB, but she probably never knew she had syphilis until that aneurysm blossomed and began eroding painfully through the breastbone when she was at the sanatorium. Ross would have told her what it was. She knew. By that point, Neither salvarsan nor even penicillin, had it been available, would have been of any use. When Thomas Stone bought his own cadaver in his final year of medical school, it was unheard of, but did not surprise anyone. He was planning a second complete dissection, searching for mastery of the human body. "Is Stone around?" was a common question in the casualty room, because he was the medical student who was more constant than Hogan or the other porters, always willing to stitch up a laceration or pass a stomach tube or run to the blood bank. He was the happiest of students when asked to scrub in and hold a retractor during emergency surgery. One night, Dr. Braithwaite, senior consultant surgeon and chief examiner for the Royal College of Surgeons, came in to see a patient with a high stab wound to the abdomen. Braithwaite was a legend for having pioneered a new operation for esophageal cancer, a notoriously difficult condition to cure. The patient, already inebriated, was terrified, abusive, and combative. Braithwaite, a compact man with silver hair, wore a blue three-piece suit that was the same shade as his blue eyes. He dismissed the porters restraining the patient, and he put his hand gently on the man's shoulder and said,
"Don't worry, it's going to be all right."
He kept his hand there, and the patient, staring at the elegant doctor, quieted down and stayed that way during the brief interview. Then Braithwaite examined him quickly and efficiently. When he was done, Braithwaite addressed his patient as if he were a peer, someone he might see later in the day at his club.
"I'm glad to tell you that the knife spared your big blood vessels. I am confident you are going to do very well, so I want you not to worry. I'll operate to repair whatever is cut or torn. We are going to take you to the operating theater now. Everything is going to be fine."
The docile patient extended a grubby hand of thanks. When they were out of earshot of the patient, Braithwaite asked the entourage of registrars and house officers, "What treatment is offered by ear in an emergency?" This was an old saw, particularly in Edinburgh. Still, the old saws were not well known any more, a matter that distressed Braithwaite greatly. He saw it as emblematic of a slackness in the new generation of trainees, and it was sad that only one person knew the answer, and that too a medical student of all people.
"Words of comfort, sir."
"Very good. You can come and assist me in surgery if you like, Mr.
Stone, sir. Thomas Stone."
During the surgery, Braithwaite found Thomas knew how to stay out of the way. When Braithwaite asked him to cut a ligature, Stone slid his scissors down to the knot and then turned the scissors at a 45-degree angle and cut, so there was no danger to the knot. Indeed, Stone so clearly understood his role that when the senior registrar showed up to assist, Braithwaite waved him off. Braithwaite pointed to a vein coursing over the pylorus. He asked Thomas what it was.
"The pyloric vein of Mayo, sir,"
Thomas said, and appeared about to add something. Braithwaite waited, but Thomas was done.
"Yes, that's what it's called, though I think that vein was there long before Mayo spotted it, don't you think? Why do you think he took the trouble to name it?"
"I believe it was a useful landmark to identify the pre-pyloric from the pyloric area when operating on an infant with pyloric stenosis."
"That's right," Braithwaite said. "They should really call it the pre-pyloric vein."
"That would be better, sir, because the right gastric vein is also referred to in some books as the pyloric vein, which is very confusing."
"Indeed it is, Stone," Braithwaite said, surprised that this student had picked up on something that even surgeons with a special interest in the stomach might not know. "If we have to give it an eponym, maybe call it the vein of Mayo if we must, or even the vein of Latajet, which seems to me much the same thing. Just don't call it pyloric."
Braithwaite's questions became more difficult, but he found the young man's knowledge of surgical anatomy to be shockingly good. He let Thomas close the skin, and he was gratified to see him use both hands to take his time. There was room for improvement,
but this was clearly a student who'd spent many waking hours tying knots one-handed and two-handed. Stone had the good sense to stick to a two-handed knot, tied well and with care, rather than showing off to Braithwaite with one-handed knots. The next morning, when Braithwaite returned, he found Stone asleep in a chair at the bedside in the recovery room, having kept an all-night vigil on the patient. He did not wake him. At year's end, after passing his final exams, when Thomas was appointed to the coveted position of Braithwaite's house officer, Sean Grogan, a bright and well-connected medical student, found the courage to ask Braithwaite what he might have done to be selected instead of Stone.
"It's quite simple, Grogan," Braithwaite said. "All you have to do is know your anatomy inside out, never leave the hospital, and prefer surgery over sleep, women, and grog."
Grogan became a pathologist, famous as a teacher in his own right, and famous for his extraordinary girth. During the war, Thomas was commissioned. He traveled with Braithwaite to a field hospital in Europe. In 1946, he returned to Scotland, became a junior registrar, then a senior registrar. He'd skipped a real childhood and gone directly to doctorhood. Ross came to Scotland on a rare visit. He told Thomas how proud he was of him.
"You're my consolation for never having married. That wasn't by choice, by the way, not being married. Perfection of the life or of the work? I could only do the one. I hope you don't make that mistake."
Ross planned to retire near the sanatorium, to play rummy at the Uti Club every night, to catch up on a lifetime of reading, and to learn to play golf with the retired officers who lived there. But just as he did, a cancer made itself known in Ross's good lung. Thomas returned to India at once. He stayed with Ross for the next 6 months, during which time the cancer spread to his brain. Ross died peacefully, Thomas at his side, the faithful Muthu, old and grey, on the other side, with many nurses and attenders who had worked with Ross holding vigil. The funeral brought Europeans and Indians from as far away as Bombay and Calcutta to pay tribute. Ross was buried in the same cemetery where many of his patients rested. "They are heroes, one and all those who sleep in this cemetery," said the Reverend Duncan at the graveside service. "But no greater hero, and no humbler a man, and no better servant of God is buried here than George Edwin Ross." Thomas took an appointment as a consultant surgeon in the Government General Hospital, Madras. But after independence in 1947, things were not the same. Indians now ran the Indian Medical Service, and they were not excited by Englishmen who wanted to stay on, though many did. Thomas knew he had to leave. If it had ever been his land, it no longer was. And that was how, in response to a notice from Matron in the Lancet, he made his voyage on the Kalangute to Aden. It was on that ship that Sister Mary Joseph Praise literally fell into his arms and entered his life. Thomas Stone believed there existed within him the seeds for harshness, for betrayal, for selfishness, and for violence. After all, he was his father's son. He believed the only virtues passed down to him were the virtues of his profession, and they came through books and by apprenticeship. The only suffering that interested him was that of the flesh. For the heartache and the grief of his own loss, he had found the cure, and he'd found it by himself. Ross had it wrong, or so Thomas thought. Perfection of the life came from perfection of the work. Thomas stumbled on an address by Sir William Osler to graduating medical students in which the man articulated this very thesis. "The master word is work, a little one, as I have said, but fraught with momentous sequences if you can but write it on the tablets of your hearts and bind it upon your foreheads." "The master word is work." Stone bound it to his forehead. He wrote it on the tablet of his heart. He woke to it and fought sleep for it. Work was his meat, his drink, his wife, his child, his politics, his religion. He thought work was his salvation. until the day he found himself seated in Our Lady of Perpetual Succor, in the room of a child he had abandoned. Only then did he admit to his son how completely work had failed him. Chapter 46. Room with a View. He stopped talking at this point. In the silence that followed, it seemed to me he was debating what to tell me next. When he resumed, I thought at first that he had leapfrogged over his years at missing, dismissed the existence of my mother, and I nearly said something rude to interrupt him. But I'm glad I didn't, because what followed was all about her. The oaks and maples outside the window of his room are wild men with their heads on fire. He shuts his eyes, but the view inside his eyelids is the same nightmare. His nerves are lancinating cables under his skin that send jolts of electricity to his muscles. He is so tremulous that when he brings a glass of water to his lips, he has spilled most of it before he can take a sip. He pukes his insides out, till he imagines the lining of his stomach is smooth and shiny like a copper pot. But the impulse to run is gone. He has put one or perhaps two oceans between him and the place he flees. Eli Harris and another man, a doctor perhaps, judging by his detachment, leave him tincture of paregoric in a tiny bottle by the bedside. Thomas fails to see it at first, imagining that the peculiar scent of aniseed and camphor is a hallucination. But once he spies the bottle, he drinks it as if it holds redemption. The antiseptic odor fills the room, and then it comes off his breath. It is the tiny amount of opium in paregoric that gives him some ease, or so he tells himself. Surely it isn't the alcohol base of the tincture. He is done with alcohol. The only two women he has ever loved have died, and though one death occurred years before the other, they became superimposed in his brain. It made him lose his mind. He fled. He ran without knowing where to or what from. He has now run far enough. He has no memory of how he arrived in New Jersey from Kenya, except that he has a benefactor, Eli Harris. A week passes, measured not in days, but in cold sweats and night terrors. It is 2 weeks before the agitation and the shakes ease, and before the ugly little invertebrates begin a retreat. For so long they have been on his skin and on the edge of his sheets, scurrying to the periphery of his vision when he turns to look at them. Now they retreat to the chitinous underworld from where they came. There is bread and cheese by his bed, sitting on a newspaper that is 2 days old. The paregoric bottle is empty. A pitcher of water has been refilled. When at last he feels it safe to take his chair to the window, the leaves have gone from carrot to brick to crimson and every hue in between, a palette beyond the imagination of any painter. He sits there like a statue, grateful for being able to sit, to see things for what they are. Leaves spiral down, each descent unique and never to be repeated. A million voyagers leave their invisible trails in the air. One morning, he is steady enough to go downstairs. A sparrow hops on the warped wood of the porch, the varnish flaking under its feet. Stone sees the ginger kitten inching forward from the wisteria, its shoulder blades gliding like pistons under its fur. He wonders if he is hallucinating. The kitten's unblinking eyes are locked on its prey. The bird tilts its head like a coquettish woman to regard man and beast. Just when Thomas thinks the tension is unbearable, the kitten pounces, but the sparrow hops easily to the railing and out of reach. Thomas feels something crack inside, releasing him from the torpor that stifled his movements and slowed his thoughts. He has emerged to a world where a sparrow's fate and that of a man can be decided in the blink of a cat's eye. Such is the true measure of time. He knows the ceiling in his bedroom better than he knows his body. He has studied the molding. The decorative grooves are even in depth and width. He sees the handiwork of a craftsman.
A clumsy amateur later subdivided the house with plywood partitions and with prefabricated doors, but the master's imprint is there to see. At first, he credits the paregoric for the curious phenomenon, but it continues after the paregoric is long gone. Like a cinema projectionist,